stories and events in our 7-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host Paul Wearson. Hello, Paul.
Well, hi, Susan. Now the holiday season's kicking up and everyone's shopping. What do we have to talk about today?
With the Farm Bill ready to be voted on before the Christmas recess, we can't be distracted by the holidays when our future hangs in the balance.
Well, isn't that a little dramatic? After all, we're not all farmers, you know.
But we do need to see that our soil and water are protected, and this is something we all need to be aware of. Last weekend, the Iowa Farmers Union, one of the oldest agricultural organizations in the country, held its convention, it was the Iowa convention, right?
Yes, it was.
National, at the Hotel Petit in Perry.
I love the Hotel Petit with all their different rooms with different themes, and a new restaurant, Harvey's, is there now. And we have Aaron Lehman here today, the president of the Iowa Farmers Union, and he's going to tell us about that meeting. Now, Aaron, I hope I pronounced your last name correctly.
Yes, you have. Yes, that's wonderful.
First of all, for all of our listeners who might be unfamiliar, tell us about the Farmers Union, what it does, what its purpose is.
Sure. So the Iowa Farmers Union is dedicated to promote family farming and sustainable agriculture, and we've been around for over 100 years. We do that through promoting policies that are friendly towards family farming and sustainable agriculture. We educate the public and our members about important issues regarding those issues, and we encourage cooperation both in business structures and in our interactions as a way to promote family farming as well.
Now, does that differ from, I remember growing up, there was the NFO.
Sure. Yeah, then there still is the NFO. The NFO is largely a bargaining organization. Okay. For farmers. They're doing great work. They work across commodities, and they're still around. We work together on some things, but our focus is a little bit different.
So you look at all the farming organizations. There's Farm Bureau, NFO, your organization.
Sure.
How does your organization stand out or differ from the other organizations? For instance, different than NFO. You might have a different mission.
Sure. Our mission, what we're probably most well known for, is advocating both in Des Moines and in Washington for policies that promote family farming. Our members tell us that sets us apart is that we're a true grassroots organization. And our meeting this past weekend reflected that. Have a very open process that people are allowed to bring their ideas forward and have them discussed, have them debated. And when in the end we pass a policy, and I've got last year's book here, but a big booklet that everyone votes on. It's all the language is debated back and forth. And in the end we come out with a set of recommendations for policy at the federal and state level that is truly a reflection of the work of all of our members.
Now, is someone lobbying on behalf of this policy that you advocate?
Correct. We have lobbying teams both in Washington and a group working with us in Des Moines as well. And the unique thing about our organization is that while we have those professionals doing a wonderful job for us both in Washington and in Des Moines, our grassroots involvement in that process really sets us apart. Who can lobby better for farming and the rural America than farmers actually going and talking to their representatives both in Des Moines and Washington?
Well, tell us about the meeting last weekend at Perry. What sort of things were talked about? Did you have some speakers come in and all this sort of thing?
Yes, we had an excellent set of speakers. One of the highlights, though, for us was on Friday we had a emerging leaders workshop. And basically it was a how-to for people to get more involved in the Farmers Union. And we had a number of people come to talk about some of the how-tos and really why is it important for ordinary people to get involved. At that event, we learned a little bit about our history. We learned the perspective from both some journalists, Rika Basu from the Des Moines Register, and from some politicians, Senator David Johnson, to hear what is an effective way to bring our message both to the media and to our elected leaders. And then we talked a little bit about what opportunities there are within the Farmers Union to become more involved.
Well, I see that you gave the keynote speech at 8:30.
I gave some welcoming comments. Yes, right. As president, I'm humbled and honored to be the Farmers Union president this year.
And I looked at all the scheduled events, and you have breakout groups. I always like these conventions because you have these breakout groups where people can focus on separate issues. And
right.
And here you had the Farm Bill, which
yes.
is very current,
uh-huh.
pesticide drift,
right.
and ongoing problems,
mm-hmm.
Opportunities for beginning farmers in the local regional food system.
Yes.
This sounds like real meaty stuff to talk about.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, with the Farm Bill, this is current. What's our status on the Farm Bill? It's sort of hanging there, isn't it?
It still is. Has not been passed yet. You know, when the last Congress met, the leadership told us this was going to be a priority to pass early, before the deadlines, before anything else, so we could provide some stability for our farmers out there and all the food system programs, conservation programs that go along with it. Unfortunately, the system got bogged down. Now the Senate actually showed quite a bit of willingness to work together. The Senate version got 86 votes and passed a bipartisan farm bill, a true working compromise. The House, on the other hand, brought a farm bill up. It was very, very partisan, had some very drastic cuts to the nutrition programs, failed, had to go back to work and try again. No, compromises were barely brokered at all. A very partisan farm bill only got votes from one side of the aisle, did eventually pass. The two versions were very, very different.
So we're in a situation now where they're trying to resolve these.
That's
two.
Right. Now, the good news is that they do feel like after the election that there was a compromise that was agreed to. Most of those draconian cuts on the nutrition side were taken out. There'll be some minor rule changes to the nutrition programs, relatively minor. But the targeting of some of our most vulnerable in society was largely removed. So we're hopeful that next week we'll see a version that looks more like the Senate side actually get voted on. We were hoping that would happen this week, but understandably with the events regarding President Bush's passing, I think the calendar has been pushed back a little bit. So we're hopeful that we'll see the final details and see some action next
week. So there must be some time sensitivity here. Are there programs that expire and that sort of thing?
Absolutely. When a farm bill expires, there's a number of programs dealing with conservation, rural development, and so on that just simply expire. And usually no funding exists for them for an entire year when that happens.
Wow, that's kind of scary.
Yeah, the interruption is very,
but we're still within
damaging.
A time frame where this can be fixed, and that can be passed at a decent level in time with the compromises written into the bill that have been negotiated already. So at this point, do you see that the Farm Bill might be passed in a very near future then?
We think in the very near future we're going to see it done. And that only makes sense that we do it now. Even if we were to reboot this process with a new Congress, there would be some we would hope to make some advantages, but to be honest, those decisions should be made now by this Congress so we can provide some certainty.
Well, that's good. And also what piques my interest, because I live right in the midst of agricultural land.
Absolutely.
And I have trees and shrubs and things I've done decoratively at the farm.
Uh-huh.
And this is pesticide drift.
Oh, sure.
Tell me about that. How big of a problem is it?
Well, we're continuing to experience a lot of problems in rural Iowa with pesticide drift, and really around the country. What we've found is that in the rush to bring new products to the marketplace to deal with increasingly persistent weed issues, weeds that are tougher and tougher to kill. We've rushed some products out there that really didn't have the proper protocols in place and the proper safeguards in place to, so that the pesticide stays where it is intended to stay. Now, the vast majority of farmers are doing a very good job of applying pesticides in a way that respects the crops and the neighbors, but unfortunately, we're having some incidences that are happening simply because we think the product was rushed out into the marketplace without the proper safeguards in place.
So basically, we're talking about, well, I observe that the folks who farming the surrounding land, when they apply pesticides, it seems that they really wait for fairly calm winds
Absolutely.
And are somewhat considerate about drift. And mm-hmm. so I feel fortunate that I'm not affected by it as far as I know. But there are crop dusting planes flying.
Sure.
And, that was not part of my youth. We didn't do crop dusting in Iowa.
Yeah.
And, our farmland is so close in that the crop duster just barely clears my crib.
Right.
That's kind of frightening. But the main thing is that what you have here is an awareness program to say, hey, this is a problem, and how do we deal with it, and how much are we aware of it, and how do we convey our concerns about it?
Yes, and what protections are there for the neighbors who are of fields that are implying improperly? Now, again, the vast majority of farmers are doing a very good job. What we see, though, is that sometimes with operations that are brought in that are not familiar with the territory, in the heavy spray seasons, applicators from long ways away are brought in and might not have as good a lay of the land, might not have a good understanding of the conditions here. We see a lot of conditions like that, unfortunately. And other times, even when farmers are doing everything right, the product was not properly formulated and the safeguards were not put in place, that even when everything is done right, we're seeing some issues.
Well, my question is there an accumulating body of case law that has been resulted from farmers or individuals suing or bringing legal action?
Yes, but it's very, very difficult. And for the state to bring action, the state has very limited resources. It's very tough to bring an effective action. And to be honest, we in the state, we are lagging behind some of our other states in the amount of protections that that applicators need to have in case they have some damages. Are they can they face the consequences in a reasonable way so that these can get resolved? Is there proper insurance in place?
Yeah.
Is there proper indemnities in place? And Iowa is not up to several of our neighbors who have tried to put these protections in
place. That's interesting. Why do you think that is, Aaron?
Well, we're trying to operate in an atmosphere in agriculture where we have very, very thin margins. Farm income is dropping again this year for 5 out of 6 years. And that's going on across the industry. Everyone is trying to tighten their belt, operate as efficiently as possible. And unfortunately, sometimes those safeguards don't keep up with the atmosphere that people are operating under economically. And the other thing to remember, too, is that we've tried very hard here to encourage farmers to make the most as they possibly can from their farm that fits for their family. In some cases, that's going to mean raising some product that has an extremely high return or high gross income per acre. Fruits and vegetables, for instance, are obviously going to be yielding a lot more in a return per acre situation than my corn and soybeans.
Well, there are farmers up in my area who are growing beets, I believe.
Sure.
And that might be an example of a high income.
And so how to put the proper protections in place so that if an incident happens, someone who is growing on those circumstances can be protected, it's extremely important. It's not easy just to get the returns back after an incident happens in those circumstances.
Well, I like this breakout group because you had some people who have great expertise here.
Yes.
Who were doing that breakout group, so I'm sure that a lot of people learned a lot.
Absolutely. Dr. Hartzler joined us from Iowa State University, and Carmen Black from the Pesticide Action Network, and who also farms, and then one of our farmers who's working through some very difficult situations, were able to give some insight, and so that was very worthwhile.
Well, I'm a graduate of Luther College in Decorah. I'm even wearing the appropriate sweatshirt today.
I noticed that.
And I'll tell you, I noticed in your third breakout group, opportunities for beginning farmers in the local regional food system. Mm-hmm. You had Toby Kane. He's the sustainability coordinator at Luther College. And so you brought in a giant there, I'm sure. But I like this whole lot. Beginning farmers. Now,
yes.
You know, our family has been on my farm since 1930. My dad started farming with horses, and then my grandfather bought the farm in 1903. And, you know, my experience directly relating to farming and growing up was endless hours cultivating corn in the 50s and walking beans and all that sort of thing. But my gist here that I'm getting at is, how does someone begin in farming if you're not in the family lineage of inheriting the farm? Is it possible to do that now?
Well, there are some wonderful opportunities out there. If the USDA puts out statistics that tell us what's happening with the size of farms, and they divide that into five quintiles, right? The largest, and so on down the line, 20%. The number of farmers in each of those categories is changing. The middle sizes of those farms are going down in number.
Well, would that
fewer
be like
and fewer
the old
farmers?
Well, when I grew up, you could raise a family on 160 acres. Is that the mid-level farm?
Well, in these days, that for crop production, that would be considered on the smaller end.
Okay.
And so there are many more farmers in the larger category. We know there's consolidation going on that's encouraging larger operations. There's some real serious issues with the consolidation. The other remarkable thing about that those numbers is that the number of smaller farmers is increasing.
You're talking about people who are raising crops for farm-to-market, farmers'
some
market
cases,
and that sort of thing?
They might be a smaller-scale livestock operation. They may be doing direct marketing. They may be marketing to community-supported agriculture. They may be doing all sorts of number of things. A lot of our beginning farmers are, of course, in that category.
So there's growth at both ends of the continuum.
Right.
The small farm that's doing market-ready things, and then you have the well, when I look around me at Story City up there, you might have a farmer doing 4,000 acres. He's got the family farm, and then he rents other farmland adjacent or nearby that's owned by other families but not farmed by them. That seems to be the trend. And I read recently that the average age of the Iowa farmer is 58.
Yeah, I think maybe even – that might even be on the low end. It might even be more than that. Yeah. It's – and so – we've got some serious issues here, right? We have a new generation of farmers that's needed to learn about agriculture, to find a viable place in agriculture that is good for their family and their operation from a practical economic standpoint, and is farmed in ways that are is sustainable and is good for our whole community as well. So it's a huge challenge in the big picture for agriculture.
Well, what frightens me about these stats is that, well, large corporations acquire great deals of farmland. Right now, when I look around me up there, as I say, it's a traditional family farm, families I've known for years who've farmed. But the surrounding farms are owned by the descendants of the original farmers I knew in the 50s, and they're taking rental income off that. But none of them are involved in farming.
Right, right, yeah.
So that is somewhat comforting because the same families own the land. It's just being used differently. And then I also noticed that the infrastructure that we built was based on the assumption there might be four farm families in every section.
Yes.
And that's no longer true. So you have consolidation of schools.
Right.
You have the degradation of local – business communities on Main Street.
Yes.
And so that's the big challenge of the population loss in rural areas. That's also a big issue.
Absolutely. And our policy we just passed at our convention very clearly states that we think we're overall in a much better situation when we have a broad network of independent producers who are making a good living on their land, are protecting the land and water, and they're contributing to their local communities.
Before you leave, I want to ask you something that I thought would come up when you talked about the Farm Bill. Part of the reason I thought to call you was because of an op-ed in the Des Moines Register by the Isaac Walton League about the CRP, the conservation set-asides.
Sure.
And is there something that – I mean, he wrote that, I think, actually hoping that people would get involved in some kind of lobbying. And do you – is it too late for that?
No, until we have a farm bill that's done, it's not too late for people to get involved and talk to their representatives and senators. Things are just always unpredictable in the Farm Bill process. So, people still should be very much involved. And our conservation programs, I don't know the – no one knows the exact details of what the current anticipated compromise is going to look like. But so until that happens, we need to keep involved and keep very vigilant to make sure that our, for instance, our very important conservation programs are remains
For our radio audience, the CRP is a program where farmers are subsidized for taking marginal farmland and using it for conservation purposes, right?
Yes.
And so the funding needs to be available for that, and that's
right.
What the issue is. So,
yes, the funding levels and the structure of those programs as well is extremely important in this Farm Bill debate.
Yeah.
Well, Aaron Lehman, it's so nice to have you here. Thanks for coming down.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
It's been educational. I look at the brochure from your meeting last weekend at the Hotel Patti in Perry, and there are pictures of all your speakers and people who are involved, and they're all good-looking, well-scrubbed. And it looks like
we clean up nice sometimes.
We made a lot of important contributions last week, and we're going to have you back at some future date just to see what the pulse of the country is.
Oh, I would love that. It's always a pleasure. Oh.
Yeah, you're very good on the air, so consider a second career.
Oh, well, I better work on my current one, right?
Yeah, because otherwise you'll be in our salary range.
Which is zero, by the way.
Yeah, right. I understand.
Well, Susan, now it's up to you. Yeah. Thanks again, Aaron.
Thank you very much. I appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you. In case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. This is Susan Franzen, and I'm here with my co-host Paul Wearson. We've just heard from Aaron Lehman, president of the Iowa Farmers Union, telling us about the recent state convention, particularly the aspects of the Farm Bill that will make a difference to all of us. And now I believe it's time to turn to the ways two holidays in Central Iowa are being celebrated with activities that are unfamiliar to most of us. We'll introduce our first guest with some music you suggested, Paul.
The Mannheim Steamroller. They have these great Christmas songs, and so we're going to put that on the air and wake everybody up.
That's right.
Kristen, our next guest is a friend of mine, Kristen Johnson. She's Youth Director and Family Ministry at St. Peter Lutheran Church in Story City, Iowa. And Kristen, I hope you're there.
Yes, good morning, Paul.
Well, actually, you're talking to us from Minneapolis. You're visiting family up there.
And I am.
I want you to know we brought you on with Mannheim Steamrollers. That's your theme. It sounded great.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, what we're doing today, Kristen, is talking about the holidays and various activities and actual learning experiences for young people in the art of giving and sharing during Christmas. And, full disclosure, I work with Kristen. That's my church. And together we work with the middle school and high school kids. And tell us what we're going to do tonight, Kristen.
Well, tonight we are taking both the middle school and the high school youth into Ames to do angel tree shopping for children and youth in our Roland Story community. And so this is something we've been doing for, this will, I think, believe, be our eighth year of doing this. And it's just a wonderful night of the youth to do service.
Yeah, you might explain to our audience the Angel Tree program. How is that and what happens with Angel Tree?
Yeah, the Angel Tree program is run through the elementary school. And it is a service for families that need just a little extra help during the Christmas season, and so to provide gifts for their children and youth. And so they apply through the elementary school and provide their children's names and items that they would need or would like for Christmas, and then those are provided for the community, either through church or you can contact the school directly to receive some of the, you don't receive the actual children's names, but you receive slips that have all the information that you would need to be able to purchase a gift for that child.
And so that family has indicated what their needs are, and maybe they have the sizes, the clothing sizes for the children and the sex of the children, right?
Yes, that provides the gender of the child, and then whether they would like a toy or whether it's a clothing item, their size, particular colors that they like, and so forth. And so we receive these slips, and then we take them into Ames with us to go shopping.
Well, that's always fun. And tonight I anticipate the same experience because you're going to have all these kids fanning out through the department store, armed with the information they have about the children's sizes and their desires. And there are always discussions about what's appropriate in the toy area. And they might be they might be prejudiced by their own taste in toys, you know.
Well, exactly, and it's a great learning experience for the youth to figure out how expensive. I hear every year, oh gosh, these are so expensive. We only have, I give them X amount of money that we have been able to raise, and then so on each slip, I'll provide like you have $25 to spend, or you have $60 to spend. And every year you get messages back from the youth like, I didn't realize that toys cost so much, or I didn't realize that I could only buy two pairs of pants with this amount of money. And so it's a very eye-opening experience. It also helps the youth to use their math skills that they're learning in school, because now they have to figure out, okay, if there's a sale price, how do we calculate the sale price, and calculating sales tax and things like that. And so it helps the youth on many levels. It's an eye-opening experience. It helps them to use their skills they're learning in math. And that's also an opportunity for them to serve their peers, because a lot of the stuff that we end up purchasing go towards some of their own peers. So it's a wonderful service to provide for the youth.
Yeah, when I'm walking around the store with them, one of them has a calculator, and they're, you know, this total is accumulating, and they made understand finally what mom and dad go through and budgeting processes, like you say.
Yes, but, absolutely. They get their phones out and get the calculator going, and they have to figure out all that, and it's a lot of fun to watch them figure that out. And it's also really good for them to realize that what they may think is a you know, a great gift like a toy, but some of these children, you know, for them to receive a new pair of shoes or to receive even new socks, that is a wonderful gift for some children. And And so it's just an eye-opening for them to realize, like, oh, I guess receiving shoes would be kind of a fun thing to get on Christmas.
Yeah, see, the kids we take down there would dread getting underwear and socks for Christmas.
Yes, exactly.
And then they start to think, well, these people need underwear and socks. It's another way of looking at life through their parents' eyes, in a way. And tell us
Absolutely.
About how the fundraising was done here. The kids were involved in fundraising for this, too.
Yeah. In order for it to be something that an ownership in what they are doing, we have the youth the week before. So this last week, they came to youth group. Both the middle school and the high school youth came to youth group, and they made cookies, everything from chocolate chips to snickerdoodles to sugar cookies that we then decorated. And so it was just a night of baking, which is just wonderful. Again, a great experience for these youth to figure out how to bake. And so then all these cookies we made, and we made hundreds of cookies, because then what we do is the following Sunday, so this past Sunday, is we then provide these cookies during fellowship hour. Excuse me, fellowship hour at church.
And then there was the cookie walk, too, which was an opportunity for the community to come in and buy cookies at the church. Is that right?
Yeah, that was a separate activity that was provided through St. Petrie for the cookie walk.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And so.
Well, I really think that, you know, having shared that experience myself, it's just a great learning experience for children. And it's an opportunity for them to think beyond themselves and know from what they're doing, not only in fundraising, but the actual shopping, that they're actually helping directly people who are very close in this community, and they're sensitive to needs that they themselves may not have. And then when we get back to the church, it's gift wrapping time, right, Kristen?
Oh, yes, and it is always fun to watch youth who have never wrapped a gift, because so many gifts these days are just put into gift bags. And so, but for the Angel Tree program, they require gifts to be wrapped. And so it is always fun to help a youth learn how to wrap a gift. And so, yeah, we then, once we get all the gifts back to church, we spend several minutes to up to an hour wrapping all of the gifts that we had just purchased. And so, and then we will then deliver them and it's actually the gifts are delivered to Emmanuel Lutheran in Story City. So, and that's always fun, too, to then bring all of these gifts that we had just purchased and wrapped.
Well, you know, it just occurs to me in our discussion here that this is really training to become parents, because gift wrap, you buy, you budget, you try to get into the needs and understanding of what other people's desires are for Christmas and their needs, too. So it's a chance to be an adult for a couple of nights, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And it's great for our adults, because all of the youth, we need to, in order to get all the youth down, we take about 60 youth between the middle school and high school. So we got to get them down to AIM. So, you know, we ask parents and other caring adults to help with that. And so then the youth go around the store with the adults. And so it's also an opportunity for these adults to just spend time with the youth, getting to know them and helping them make decisions about shopping as well, even though the decision is up to the youth on what they purchase, but we always have adults with them as well. So it's just another opportunity for the youth to interact with other caring adults in our community through this ministry as well. So it's just a wonderful thing all around.
That's what I get out of it, because I'll be one of the drivers tonight, and we will be taking the kids down to Ames and shopping and all that entails, and then I might be a consultant on wrapping. I love to wrap gifts, and so I may actually...
You are very good at that, Paul.
Well, I might train them. But what we're doing here, talking for our radio audience out here, we're talking with Kristen Johnson, who's family minister and youth director at St. Petrie Lutheran Church, and we're picking you out because I know you, but I know that the scope of this is much larger, that most churches have similar activities. Isn't that right, Kristen?
Yes. Other churches find other ways to serve the children and youth in our communities, and this is just one way that we have chosen to do that.
And then every summer we have a mission trip, and we're going this year to Arkansas, I believe. And you might tell us a little bit about that mission trip, because that really hands-on go to a different area and culture experience.
Yes, we're going to be taking There's 12 youth who have signed up and four adults, and we are going to go to Marvel, Arkansas this summer. And on our way, we're going to stop in Memphis, Tennessee, and go to the Civil Rights Museum that is there. And so I'm always impressed with our youth that they choose places that are maybe off the beaten path that they would not travel to themselves. And so in a place that they would like to go and learn about and to grow from, not just to be the hands and feet of Christ in that community, but to also learn something about themselves and about their culture. And so this is a great opportunity for our youth. And so we're really looking forward to being able to go down to Marvel, Arkansas. And we'll be doing children's ministry as well as home improvements and painting and things like that. And so it's just a great opportunity for the youth and the adults that will be going with us as well to serve in this community and to learn from them. And it'll be quite the cultural experience for them as well.
Well, Kristen, it's been delightful to talk to you. Have a safe trip back to Story City from the Twin Cities, and I'll be seeing you tonight to help you with that project. Kristen Johnson, youth minister and family ministry at St. Petri Lutheran Church. We've had a look there at how Christians work and labor and give during the holidays. And we're going to have in our next segment, actually, Kristen, is going to be with the local Jewish traditions here in Ames.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank you, Paul, for this opportunity.
Yes. Now, right now, as a transition into the segment of our show that's going to be oriented toward Hanukkah and Jewish traditions, this is a wonderful number, Light One Candle.
Light one candle for the Maccabee children, with thanks for their light, it didn't die. Light one candle for the pain they endured, when their right to exist was denied. Light one candle for the terrible sacrifice justice and freedom demand. Light one candle for the wisdom to know, when the peacemaker's time is at hand. For so many years, don't let the light go out. Let it shine through our love and our tears. Don't let the light go out. It's lasted for so many years. Don't let the light go out. Let it shine through our love and our tears. Light one candle for the strength that we need to never become our own foe. And light one candle for those who are suffering pain we learned so long ago. Light one candle for all we believe in. Let anger not tear us apart. And light one candle to bind us together with pieces of song in our hearts. Don't for so many years. Don't let the light go out. Let it shine through our love and our tears. Don't let the light go out. Don't let the light go out. It's lasted for so many years. Don't let the light go out. Don't let the light go out. Let it shine through our love and our tears. And what is the memory that's valued so highly that we keep it alive in that flame? What's the commitment to those who have died when we cry out they have not died in vain? Well, we are convinced for always believing that justice will somehow prevail. This is the burden, this is the promise, and this is why.
That's the song to introduce the second celebration we'll talk about today, Hanukkah, which started on Sunday, December 2nd, and lasts until Monday, December 10th. You just heard a traditional Hanukkah song, Light One Candle, sung by Peter, Paul, and Mary from their 25th anniversary concert.
Well, now, Peter, Paul, and Mary, I spent some time with them. They came for a concert at Luther College, and so I took the men golfing while Mary waited at the motel and got mad at us. They were very professional, wonderful folks, and Mary's passed away now, but I really enjoyed my time with them. They were professional, and I think Peter Yarrow was Jewish. I'm not sure about Paul, but I know that he was from the Jewish tradition. So today, our guests are, and Susan, you can introduce them.
Rabbi Lebo Jacobson. I asked you earlier, about, is that Norwegian?
Yeah, it's funny. I didn't even know about that. That would be Norwegian. It's originally the name is Jacobson, which is in Hebrew, and then it was just translated into English, which is Jacobson. Yeah.
And Mocha Jacobson, yes. And does the rabbi's wife have a title?
It would be Rabbitson.
Robinson. Yeah. And so they're here, and I'm Rabbi Lebo handed me his cell phone to read the holiday of Hanukkah has a universal message for all people to bring light, warmth, and festivity into the world. Each person with their own unique ability has the responsibility and mission to add light, warmth, and hope into the world.
It's every person has their own mission to add light and love into the world during the Hanukkah and holiday season. So there we go.
When I was looking for a Jewish person to come and tell us about Hanukkah, I was recommended your name, and I'm very pleased because I understand that you represent a different branch of Judaism than the Jewish congregation. Please introduce yourself then a little more and tell about why you're here.
Well, we're glad to be here. Thanks for having us. We're just we're Chabad of Ames, Chabad Lubavitch of Ames, and we're here to be a Jewish resource for the Ames community, for those people who are Jewish, and as well as for people who are not Jewish who have questions and who are interested in Judaism, as well as for the Jewish students at Iowa State and the student body as a whole to be there as a resource.
And you you do not have a congregation. You said you're not a pulpit rabbi?
That is correct. I'm not a pulpit rabbi. We work one-on-one with people, and just being there. It's just about being there. There's no affiliation to Chabad. If we're having an event and people come, that's who comes.
And you had a pretty big event, I guess, the first of Hanukkah. Could you tell us about that?
So the first night of Hanukkah, which was Sunday, December 2nd, we had a menorah lighting at City Hall. And boy, was it a cold night. It was really cold, colder than last year. And we don't usually expect a certain number, which whoever comes. And we had a nice crowd, about 20 people came. Mr. Tim Garten, from the city committee, I believe, on the city council, lit the shamash, lit the leader of the menorah, and Dr. Friedberg made the blessings and lit the rest of the candles, which was the one candle for that night. So there was latkes and there were donuts, there was some drinks, hot drinks that were graciously sponsored by Starbucks. And dreidels and chocolate gelt, chocolate coins. So
now dreidels are the traditional symbol, almost besides the Hanukkah menorah. And so, what's the history of the dreidel? Why do you play with these little tops?
Well, the dreidel has it's a four-sided top. It has on it the four letters of a shin, nun, gimel, hey, and shin. You can play it with the chocolate coins. You can play it with real money. Some people do it with real money. It comes from when the Assyrian Greeks took over Israel and Judea, they outlawed learning Torah as fulfilling the mitzvot in the Torah, the commandments in the Torah, and children would be taught in hiding, and when soldiers came, they would take out tops and start playing with them to sort of trick the soldiers, the Assyrian soldiers, Greek soldiers.
And now this time period when the revolt of the Maccabees, which is is actually in, I checked because I remembered the Maccabees from my childhood. It's in the Bible, so that all these, you know, these Bible believing Christians have read about it, and in the same, probably pretty much the same words, because I learned something from an Israeli friend of mine once. I questioned something that I had read in the Bible, and I asked her to translate it for me, because of course Hebrew is the language of Israel. And she read it almost verbatim from the King James Version. I mean, that was exactly just what she knew from the Hebrew. So it's very, very accurate. But the story behind that, I think, is pretty dramatic. And maybe, can you tell this? I think this is why you're here. Maka.
Yes.
Yes.
So during those times when the Syrian Greeks were taking over Jerusalem and Israel, and they were very into art and into culture, but they did not like it that the Jewish people were learning the Torah, as this is a commandment. This is something to follow and to observe and to believe in God. So when they basically outlawed learning the Torah as a book that was given by God, and it was very hard for the Jewish people, because we don't look at the Torah as just a culture, as just a beautiful book to learn and to read, but as a way of life. And so that's when they had the story of the dreidels and the children who were learning in the caves and hiding away, trying to continue learning in secret. Yeah.
Yeah, you're really talking about a time in Jewish history. And there were other times, too, the captivity in Babylon. Of course, in the Christian tradition, we read about the time of Jesus when the Romans were occupying the country. And in each case, the Jewish people had to preserve their culture and religion in various ways. And you're really talking about how they had to do that in secret from an occupying army. And so, but you might explain to the general public out there just exactly what Hanukkah is, the celebration, its background, and why Hanukkah is celebrated by Jews worldwide.
So really the whole holiday of Hanukkah is about overcoming and the few against the mighty and the miracles that God did. There was a small group of Jewish people, high priests at that time, who decided we are going to fight and we're going to do whatever we can. And they were called the Maccabees. And they created a small army and they said, whoever is for God, come with us. And they fought against the large, mighty army and they won. And that was a great miracle. The other miracle of Hanukkah, which we celebrate, was the finding of the small flask of oil. They had a custom in the temple to light the menorah every day. And after the Greeks had come into the temple and defiled it, the Jewish people came in and were looking for some oil to light the menorah. And all of the flasks of oil were destroyed and were smashed on the ground. And finally, they found a small flask of oil and they lit the menorah. And that was only meant to last for one day. And it ended up lasting for 8 days. And so we celebrate the miracle of the lasting of the oil. And we celebrate light and miracles and strength and courage to continue, you know, going on and being strong.
My understanding is that there's a lighting of a candle for each day of Hanukkah then. And so at the time that Hanukkah's ended, all the menorah is lit.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a nice tradition. And so that's preserved in families. Yeah. And, of course, I'm a Norwegian, okay? And
we, okay, so now we know how
well,
Norwegian
yeah, well, now we, I know a lot of Jacobsons.
Okay?
But the main thing
Jacobson's
is that
names.
We have traditions that are onious to me. A lot of people in America call lutefisk and lefse, this horrible fish, you know. And so I'm sure that there are foods associated with Hanukkah, too.
Yes.
What sort of foods are consumed as a tradition?
Okay, so for the holiday of Hanukkah, being that there was the miracle of the oil lasted for 8 days, so we eat fried food associated with oil. So you have potato pancakes, or traditionally called latkes. And in Israel, they have something which is called sufganiyot, jelly donuts. So we have jelly donuts, and we have them here in America, too. It's not just in Israel. But they're also fried. Some people have sour cream with their latkes. Some people have applesauce with their latkes. You can have it with whatever choice you want to have it with. And then there's the idea of the gelt. Why do we give gelt on presents? And we talked about this yesterday, and I actually looked up and read in some Jewish books. The idea of presents and gelt, which means money, is because you're supposed to give charity over Hanukkah. And gifts represent that type of idea. So we spoke about yesterday that it's maybe because it's closer to other holidays that the idea is to give gifts. One of the commandments in the Torah is to give a tenth of your whatever you make during, let's say, the week. So the idea of giving Hanukkah gelt, or the chocolate coins, which is a gimmick, is the idea of continuing the commandment of giving tithes, which was one of the commandments that were outlawed during the time of the Maccabees.
So that's the origin of the Christian tradition of tithing also.
Correct.
You know, the 10%. And so we're all familiar with that. It's an interesting thing how all these traditions, because Christianity, of course, is based on the Jewish tradition, because Jesus was a Jew, and this all grows out of the Old Testament. And when you look at the Bible, the Old Testament's this thick, and the New Testament is... I'm using my fingers here for all my radio audience to show you how thin the New Testament is. And so you have all these traditions that are just lovely. I'm glad that they're preserved here in Ames, Iowa, too. I hope you can get all these foods at the store at Ames. Is that true? Can you do that?
Latkes, maybe. I know Trader Joe's up in Des Moines has West Des Moines has they have latkes. Jelly donuts, at least kosher jelly donuts. I'm not sure if you can get those in Ames.
Boy, I'm sorry that we're running out of time, because we could talk a lot about these traditions and your own tradition within the Jewish faith, and how that relates to what's going on in Central Iowa and existing congregations. I lived in Des Moines for 30 years, and I knew a lot of folks down there who went to the synagogue out there in the west side, and it's a beautiful building. And I knew two concentration camp survivors during my time. One was Dave Fischel, who had a delicatessen, and he said, "Yes, I'm fat, but I didn't eat for 4 years."
Yeah, I actually grew up with David Fischel as a kid. Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been nice to meet you.
Hanukkah, yontef ha-sheiner, ha-lustiger, ha-freilicher, niton ha-zeiner, alle nacht in dreidel spielen mir, zudikese latkes essen mir, geschwinder sind Kinder, die Chaneke lichte lachon. Lo mir alle singen, lo mir alle springen, und lo mir alle tanzen in Korn. Lo mir alle singen, und lo mir alle springen, und lo mir alle tanzen in Korn. Hanukkah, oh Hanukkah, come light the menorah. Let's have a party, we'll all dance the horror. Gather round the table, we'll give you a...
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Paul Wilson and I, Susan Franzen, have been your hosts for today. Other voices you heard were Aaron Lehman, Kristen Johnson, Label, and Malka Jacobson.
Well, you could listen to today's local talk show and any of our past local talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. And there you will find also the information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. Now, that's khoifm.org. There are also rebroadcasts of this morning's show today at noon and 7 p.m.
Local Talk was engineered by Aladdin. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Christmas by Manham Steamroller from their CD, Christmas. And Light One Candle by Peter, Paul, and Mary from their CD, Peter, Paul, and Mary, a 25th Anniversary Concert. And Hanukkah, Oh Hanukkah by Aaron Sander, sung by Theodore Bacall.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878, or you can contact us through our website, khoifm.org. Now, that's also where you need to go to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for that yellow donate button right there on the website.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI is provided in part by Stevens Auditorium, presenting the Nutcracker, Saturday, December 8th at 1:30 and 7:30 p.m., and Sunday, December 9th at 1:30 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at center.iastate.edu.